For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website. So, good morning, everybody. Thanks for being here on this really snowy and cold day. I have a bunch of things I want to talk about today, all of which I think can be loosely grouped under the heading of language and its limitations. And so I want to talk about some Zen and Buddhist perspectives on language, but also on the limitations of language. You know, we have in our 16 Bodhisattva precepts, we have the traditional Bodhisattva precept of not using false speech, which, you know, I think we think of as not lying, not passing along inaccurate information. And this is, I think it comes from, you know, the category of right speech from the Noble Eightfold Path of the Buddha's teaching on the means to ending suffering. And, you know, it does. It includes speaking truthfully, using words that are friendly, benevolent, meaningful, and useful, not speaking carelessly, respecting the context of time and place with our speech, you know, all ways of being careful with our speech. And I think, you know, part of the reason for that is that our speech is just as powerful, sometimes more powerful than our actions with, you know, interacting with the world. But also, maybe, you know, kind of inherently points to the fact that language is important. Language is a part of us. We can't get away from our use of language, even though sometimes language can really serve to separate us from our experience. And we start maybe applying linguistic concepts to things and then just relating to these concepts that we've made in our head, and we're you know, suddenly apart from those things. But I'm going to get into that. So the precept on not using false speech, I think we think of as applying to our own output. You know, we just will kind of clean up our speech and monitor that. But I think it's also really important to consider the input. You know, what are we taking in from the world in terms of language and concepts, and what are we doing with that? So that's mostly what I'm going to be talking about today. I want to start with a koan. I chose case 28 from the Gateless Gate, which in my translation, they have the Japanese names for the student and teacher, and so it's called Ryutan's Name Echoed Long, but that's the Japanese translation of Deshan's name. And so the student in this case, or the monk in this case, is Deshan, and his teacher is Longtan. And this was something that took place around 850 AD. And the case is, one day, Deshan kept asking Longtan for instruction till nightfall. Longtan finally said, "The night is late, why don't you go to bed?" Deshan thanked him, made his bows, raised the door curtain, and left. Seeing how dark the night was, he turned back and said, "It's pitch black outside." Longtan lit a lantern and handed it to Deshan. Just as Deshan reached for it, Longtan blew it out. At that, Deshan came to sudden realization and made a deep bow. Longtan asked, "What have you realized?" And Deshan replied, "From now on, I will not doubt the words of the old master who is renowned everywhere under the sun." The following day, Longtan ascended the rostrum and declared, "There is a man among you whose fangs are like trees of swords and whose mouth is like a bowl of blood. Strike him and he won't turn his head. Someday he will settle on the top of an isolated peak and establish my way there." Deshan brought his sutra commentaries and notes to the front of the hall, held up a torch, and said, "Even if you have exhausted abstruse doctrine, it is like placing a hair in vast space. Even if you have learned the vital points of all the truths in the world, it is like a drop of water thrown into a big ravine." He then burned all his commentaries and notes, and after making his vows, he left. So what happened here? I think as part of discussing this, it's maybe important to get into a little bit of what we learn about Deshan from the commentary on this case. And what we learn is that he was a scholar, very much prided himself on being the king of the Diamond Sutra, was an expert on the Diamond Sutra, very heavily reliant on his sutras and commentaries as the truth of Buddhism, and it was somebody who took what we might today call an intellectualized approach. He had lots of knowledge that he had learned and memorized, and yet he heard through someone that there was this Zen teaching, which was transmission outside of words and letters, and he thought this was heresy, and he had come basically to kind of refute this. And so he came to meet with Longtan to try to, maybe have a little bit of a Dharma combat with him and sort of get to the bottom of this. And so although he spent hours that night when he arrived at the monastery talking with Longtan and taking in his words and I think understood, what the words that Longtan was trying to tell him, it was really blowing out the lamp that helped Deshan to realize the immediacy of Buddha nature and of what Longtan was trying to say, not just as an intellectualization, that this physical act of suddenly somebody blows out the light, provided him an intimacy with his own experience. And so I think, this points to a lesson for us on how to approach reality. Not that language is bad, or words, or sutras, or texts, or anything, that those things have their place, but we need to not rely just on that external authority that we can learn and memorize, but also on our internal and experiential guidance. And so with that perspective, I want to talk a little bit about how this maybe shows us some of the limitations of language. We can, as maybe Deshan did, we can apply words to experience based on our prior learning or teaching from others. And that's not a bad thing. I think it was maybe partly because Deshan had done a lot of intellectual learning that he was able to have this realization in that very moment, so soon after meeting the master. So language is useful. It's useful for communicating external, concrete facts or concepts to other people. We wouldn't, and even for understanding what some things are, we wouldn't be able to live, I think, as beings without ways to really communicate our point to each other. But the words that we use don't necessarily apply to what we think we're describing. If you've ever, woken up from a dream that was fascinating, and you've tried to describe that to somebody, or even describe, just to sort of remember what you're, for yourself, you start to try to figure out how you would explain this to someone, it really falls short. And, we can't always apply words to what we think we're describing. And sometimes we do. Sometimes we do use words and concepts to describe something internal, and we wind up really being wrong. We've misapplied those words and concepts. There's in psychology, there's actually a theory of panic attacks as resulting from people misattributing their internal states. And so they're feeling, maybe what someone else might consider hunger or sadness or other sort of internal states, but they don't have a sense of what that is, and it becomes panic. So So that kind of points to the limitation of language, that language really falls short when we try to apply it to abstract experience or internal experience. And, you know, if you think about how you would describe to someone how to escape from a burning building versus, you know, how you describe to someone how to escape from overwhelming anxiety, you can really see the difference, you know? And so, you know, it's like what they say about Zen as being a finger pointing to the moon, you know, that we can't get at some things, and so you have to point to it, but language falls short. You know, we never quite get there. And so over-relying on language is, you know, can lead us astray, at least. And so that brings me to, you know, something that comes up for me around this topic these days, as I have encountered the problem of fake news. Maybe a few weeks ago, maybe a month or so ago, I started seeing, you know, articles pop up about, you know, this fake news and what a problem it is. And for a while I was like, what is it? You know, it's like I thought I understood what fake news was, but I couldn't understand why this was a problem. So I did a little research, and what I discovered is that, you know, basically fake news is stories that are published by unreliable or biased sources that are intended to manipulate the reader in some way. And so, you know, why is that a problem? So that's out there, and I think it's a problem because we can be manipulated. You know, we maybe don't always look closely enough to distinguish something that's true from something that's kinda true, or contains, you know, elements of truth, or maybe a kernel of truth. And it turns out that fake news is a problem because the internet actually contributes to making this more difficult. One of the articles I saw in the New York Times said that the danger with fake news is that people no longer know what to believe or don't believe anything. And so, you know, I read that and I was like, well, you know, why is that a problem? I think that's how I feel a lot of the time. I don't really know what to believe, and I don't necessarily believe anything. And so I had to think about it. And I think that, you know, what, from my perspective, what makes this a problem is if we take that stance of not knowing what to believe or not believing anything, if we take it as a fixed view and sort of solidify this perspective. This is maybe an element of, you know, kind of not holding to fixed views, that we need to hold on to, you know, a spirit of inquiry into something, and maybe even a spirit of skepticism, healthy skepticism, without sort of solidifying that and turning away and foreclosing and saying, oh, well, you can't believe anything, so, you know, why even bother? Or, you know, who even really knows? That's where the problem is, I think, is that when we turn away from that and seek for certainty, you know, if seeking for certainty involves saying, well, you can't believe anything, then it causes problems for us. If it helps us to open up that spirit of inquiry for ourselves, I think that that's maybe a positive thing, you know? So I started thinking about, you know, well, how can we approach this problem? And there's actually some very interesting articles that I'll get into in a minute on NPR that talk about, you know, what you can do to approach, you know, combat fake news. But as far as, you know, kind of a Buddhist perspective, I think that one teaching that we can use from, you know, the very earliest days of Buddhism is comes from the Kalama Sutra. And this was something that was written by someone around the Buddha, based on something that was going on in the time of the Buddha, which was at that time, there were lots and lots of teachers, and people would come to lots and lots of spiritual teachers, and people would, and they would promote themselves and say, you know, I have the way, and I know, you know, what this is, and here's what you have to do, and they'd give people practices, and the Buddha visited a town where the inhabitants were known as the Kalamas, and when they heard that the Buddha was coming in their town, the Kalamas paid him a visit, and they posed this question to him, and I'll just go ahead and read this from the text that I have. And they said, "Sir, there are some recluses and brahmanas who visit Keshaputta. They visit and illumine only their own doctrines and despise, condemn, and spurn others' doctrines. Then come other recluses and brahmanas, and they too, in their turn, explain and illumine only their own doctrines and despise, condemn, and spurn others' doctrines. But for us, sir, we have always doubt and perplexity as to who among these venerable recluses and brahmanas spoke the truth and who spoke falsehood." And the Buddha gave them this advice, unique in the history of religions, and I think this is really relevant. "Yes, Kalamas, it is proper that you have doubt, that you have perplexity, for a doubt has arisen in a matter which is doubtful. Now look, you Kalamas, do not be led by reports or tradition or hearsay. Be not led by the authority of religious texts, nor by mere logic or inference, nor by considering appearances, nor by the delight in speculative opinions, nor by seeming possibilities, nor by the idea, this is our teacher. But, O Kalamas, when you know for yourselves that certain things are unwholesome and wrong and bad, then give them up. And when you know for yourselves that certain things are wholesome and good, then accept them and follow them." So, what the Buddha is saying really is to, foster that spirit of inquiry and look for yourself and pay attention to your own experience. Similar to, I think, what took place in the interaction between Deshan and Longtan. So, there's that phrase, "Become a lamp unto yourself," that's attributed to the Buddha, and I think this kind of falls within that. So when we think about how to apply this to a modern problem such as fake news, some of the sources that I have discovered are suggest a few different kinds of steps. One would be to, consider the accuracy and validity of the source. You know, everything we encounter is somewhat biased. There's no world in which we have an absolutely pure and unencumbered resource of knowledge, but there are differing degrees of that. We want to think about, how biased is the source that I'm reading from, and how can I tell? Is it sponsored content? Does the author cite sources, and can I verify those sources? Are they verifiable? We maybe can do some fact checking, distinguishing for ourselves between, and this is really hard on the internet, it turns out, distinguishing between an ad and an article. They both look, in stuff that people post, especially on Facebook, they both look the same. They've got that same frame around them, and you click on them and you go there, but we still can distinguish those, by looking closely, looking up quotes that you see. Public figures are often, pretty much everything they say is verifiable, or you can find it in multiple sources that aren't just copying from each other. If there's a major event, it's going to be reported from a multitude of angles, and we can compare those. Consider the source of photos. Where are the photos coming from that are accompanying this article? Are they just stock photos, or do they directly apply to this text, or are they, somehow misleading? Looking for outside verification. As I was doing my own little bit of research for this talk, I came across a chart that people, seems to be being posted everywhere, of many different American media news sources and the degree to which they are reliable. If people are interested, I'll send this around later. There's, in the middle, it's kind of mainstream, and then they have the and they list, different ones, and then they have the ones that skew left and the ones that tend to be skewed to the right, and then the basic along the vertical axis, they have, the extent to which they meet standards of journalism. And so you can get a sense of whether a particular source is trustworthy. I noticed that there's nothing, there's no perfect source here, So for all of us, for all of these questions, we still have to, come back and forth and rely on ourselves, rely on our own judgment. There's no perfect solution, and there just isn't. So along with considering the accuracy and validity of the source and doing maybe some fact-checking on the things that we're reading, I think it's also important to consider what our own motives might be, along with those the motives of the originer, whatever we think they might be. Why do we want to believe that something is true? To what degree are we or others motivated by, greed, hate, or delusion? To what extent do we want to, we see a title and it's provocative and it stirs us up and says, yeah, I knew it. So right, it says it right there. Because it stirs up your own emotional feeling about something. To what extent does the provocativeness of a piece of news maybe even just serve to, help distract us from our own pain or our own, the mundanity of our life, to, we can get something to get excited about or galvanize, resources about. And so that's, maybe some of our own motives, and that takes some reflection. We might also want to consider, why might others want us to believe this? And I don't have an answer for that. I don't have an answer for any of this. I think this is where, like with the Kalama Sutra, we really have to continue to pay attention. And be vigilant and do some due diligence with paying attention to what we are reading and taking in. Someone made the point that because we now have the power to mass publish or pass along information, activities that were once the responsibility of people like editors or librarians are really now the responsibility of all of us, and it sounds like a lot of work, and I think it is, but I think that is, that's our responsibility as part of not using false speech. It's not using the speech, but also not taking it in unexamined. So there's that. I think it's also important to acknowledge that reality is inherently ambiguous. We cannot pin it down even for a moment. I think we sometimes chant the song of the jewel mirror samadhi, and there's that line about, when teachings, whether teachings and approaches are mastered or not, reality constantly flows. That we have to keep our mind flexible enough so that we can stay afloat, like a surfer, or if we can't always surf the news perfectly, at least sometimes maybe if we get submerged, we can, bob back up to the surface and kind of regain our equilibrium with what's coming at us. Even so, I think we can start to recognize that some perspectives really fall within the realm of falseness, often because they are fixed or exaggerated, you can't trust anything. Whereas other perspectives have a greater degree of goodness of fit with reality. And we can know that because they, we can observe maybe over time or in multiple dimensions that they do seem to fit with what there is. But if you take one thing from all the things that I'm saying, it is that there's really no strategy. There's the kind of like the things that, we talk about the middle way. There's really no strategy to this. You can't just do it and it's done and that's what I'm going to do from now on. You know, this all relies on our ability to stay very close to the spirit of inquiry and the awareness of our internal experience while we're paying attention to what's out there. And this, you know, I think can really be a part of spiritual practice, you know, the bringing that meditative inquiry to daily life so that we can find that deep peace amidst all the confusion around us. And I think that Zazen practice can really be an integral means of helping us with this, you know, because it serves as a means of helping us calm down enough so that we can observe ourselves and we can observe the flow of things around us and with us. You know, we don't maybe notice this right away. You know, you don't, it's not, you know, the first time, you know, maybe the first time we sat Zazen, we sort of came away going, wow, I feel really calm. I feel much more clarity. We don't notice that every time, you know, and you don't always feel that way, but over time, Zazen does have a transformative property that, you know, one of the I don't know, side effects or effects is to that it helps us become calmer people. And so, you know, one thing that we can do in encountering whatever kind of news is coming at us is to really notice when your calm is disrupted and use that as a signal, you know, to investigate further. That maybe helps to make us all, you know, a little harder to manipulate and a little more aware, you know, of what's happening. So, you know, the other thing we can do is to notice, you know, through our practice, when we are motivated by greed and attachment or hatred and aversion or confusion or delusion, you know, see what's going on there and then maybe consider how we can skillfully correct inaccurate information in a way that other people can take in. So, you know, this is part of how we can free ourselves and others in our daily life right now. So going back to Deshan in the koan, you know, we can think about Deshan as, you know, coming to Longtan, you know, asking his teacher and wanting to know, you know, tell me how to live, or, you know, how I should practice, or, you know, what is the meaning of my life? And, you know, this is a question that I think we all can relate to. We all have in some way. And yet often we're not always so aware of it as a question that we're having. But it's often being answered for us by our culture and by the media without our awareness. For example, advertising. There is a easy to find article from maybe the 80s or definitely no more recent than the 90s by Philip Cushman, and it's entitled Why the Self is Empty. And one of his main points is that that advertising and the media and our culture has created this sense in us of lacking, that we're lacking something. And for sure, advertising has come up as a way to say, oh, well, here's what you need. You know, you need a newer car, or, you know, you need, you know, these clothes. This will help you with what you're lacking. And what we're often lacking is more of we're lacking something in ourselves that can really be fulfilled more by our own spiritual practice or by connection with other people than it can be by, you know, new clothes. But the promise I think behind those new clothes is that, you know, you'll dress better and people will want to be around you, and then that will fill that lack. You know, so we have this feeling of, you know, tell me, I need something here, you know, tell me how to live, how to practice. And, you know, we sometimes, like Deshan, do come to spiritual practice seeking this, whether it's from, you know, whether we're seeking it from a teacher or seeking it just to find it here or seeking it through texts. You know, we have that feeling too of, I really want an answer. Just like Oh no, I can't remember. But there, I can't remember what number. But also in the Gateless Gate, there's, you know, the koan on ordinary mind is the way. You know, what is the way? You know, I need to know. So you know, although one thing that's maybe different or is being pointed out about Deshan is that although he's learned and memorized a great deal of information, he was unable to apply it to his own experience. You know, even through all the learning and all the memorization of sutras, he couldn't really quite, you know, get that for his own experience. And even despite, you know, spending the day and the night, you know, in Dharma discourse with his teacher, he still couldn't get it through language. And it was really only when the teacher gave him a direct experience by blowing out the lamp could he see actually how to find his way. And, you know, Only he, and maybe realized actually in the end that only he could find his own way. And I think that this is really true for each of us, you know, that only when we take on the responsibility of illuminating ourselves can we really be free. So, you know, so I just want to offer that as a, you know, some words of encouragement in the middle of, well, a lot of confusion. You know, I think there's right now, I feel it, and I think, you know, pretty much everybody feels it, that there's a lot of confusion, there's a lot of despair. We don't know, you know, what's even exactly going on. But we can continue to try to pay attention and to stay connected to what's going on, and even to try to help. You know, whether that's by correcting misinformation as we see it, or you know, responding as we would want to correct information. As I often think, you know, we don't have so much control over what comes at us, but when we can, you know, calm down internally, we do at least have some more choices about how we can respond. And so, you know, for that peace, you know, I think our Zazen practice can be really helpful too, as well as, you know, talking, continuing to stay in touch and talk with each other. So I think that's all I wanted to say today. If people have comments, I'd love to hear them, and maybe we can have our own Dharma discourse. But thank you. With ourselves, you mean? Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah. Yeah. I know, it takes forever to, because you're thinking about, like, well, is that, where does that come from? Or it makes you think of something else. Yeah. Yeah, great point.
The ethos of the person writing the paper, because I remember there's a couple of really interesting sort of topical examples of untruths being pushed towards us. The two most striking ones I remember was there's a movie called Cowspiracy where the interviewer finally gets a... So Greenpeace will refuse to meet with this guy who's looking into the true nature of like climate change, which is sort of odd because it's Greenpeace.
Yeah.
And so he sort of works around from a different angle and interviews one of the ladies who's in charge of like public relations for Swift and Tyson, which are the two of the largest meat factory farming companies in the world. And he sort of coaxes out of her that they're one of the larger donors to Greenpeace. So, you know, even something like Greenpeace or Surf Rider or any of those organizations do receive generous donations from companies that have the exact opposite interest of their agenda.
Yeah.
And then another one was a movie I watched called Bigger, Stronger, Faster, which is all about the use of anabolic steroids and professional sports and bodybuilding. And I remember being younger, I used to be in the weightlifting. There's all this advertisement, you know, if you take this whey protein or whatever, there's this really muscular guy. It's always funny. People who don't know anything about weightlifting will say, I wouldn't want to drink that because I want to get that big. But, you know, that person in the picture is taking 1,000 milligrams of testosterone a day. So it's really interesting, all of these things that are sold to us in these sort of linear fashion. If you do this, you'll get this. If you are this way, then you'll be that way, and these people will be attracted to you. Really, in the background, there's a whole lot of hidden agendas going on where people really aren't telling you the truth.
Yeah. Or the kind of the truth.
A version of the truth.
But they're leaving out some significant... factors.
You know, they interviewed this one guy and he said, well, I did advertise that product and I do use it, but I do also use, you know, I take 3 or 4 injections a day. So I just thought, you know, that's a topical approach that I found very interesting about just how to really cut through. You have to see who's sponsoring the paper, who's funding the organization. Is there actually any statistical significance to the finding? Are they correlations, an empirical study? And that's a lot of stuff.
Yeah, I know, it sounds like a lot of work, and I think it is a lot of work to be informed about anything.
Yeah, but then just on a side note, something, because I read sometimes 2 books a week or something like that. Thich Nhat Hanh made this point when you're reading it, or when you're talking as well, I find that your intellectual mind can really sort of, like you were saying, get away from you. Because you receive these ideas either from someone talking to you or reading a book, and immediately your mind tries to see how to fit it into your concept of reality. Like, oh, I agree with this, I don't agree with that, I've seen this happen, I haven't seen it happen. That's a nice idea. I wonder how I could, like you said, into idea of certainty. Yeah. But I find just breathing while you're reading and paying attention to breathing, and when talking, because when you're talking it's so easy to get it, using all your breath just to expel words. But, you know, it's why arguments sometimes you find completely lost track of where when you were breathing.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it helps process talking and what you actually want to say if you stop to breathe. And when you're reading, am I just trying to disagree or agree with what I think the world is when I'm reading this book? Or am I letting it sort of wash over me like rain and absorbing it?
Good testimony.
Really helps.
Yeah. And awareness, right? Something that brings you back to your present experience, it sounds like. So your head's not going out there.
Yeah. So you don't get lost in the undertow, so to speak.
Yeah. Thanks for that. Anything else anybody wants to add? Said.
Thank you for your talk. I really appreciate this koan. And I think the final sister in the Book of Equanimity with koan, which the term words are not knowing is most intimate.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think a very important point of this koan is that the teacher does not simply basically, he doesn't even let the student touch the candle, the lamp. He blows it out, and I think it's not just the act. I mean, we could interpret this, which would really take away from the meaning, but it's important to interpret it to a certain extent. When you're finding your way through the darkness, go through darkness.
Yeah, yeah. If that's what it is, that's what it is.
Go through darkness, because that's exactly it. That's what it is. I think a mistake that we run into is when we're looking at information, we evaluate it right or wrong without realizing that we're holding our own lamp. Mm-hmm. And we rush out into the darkness with our lamp, hoping to edify the world. Or is that simply our lamp? And it's terrifying to go into the darkness, because that's what we don't know. That's chaos, that's ambiguity. That's not an inch beneath our feet. That's why we have all our knowledge, to keep us an arm's length from that. But I think that's what all of the koans and all of the practices calling us to do, go into exactly what's terrifying, not knowing. So, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for elaborating on that. I agree that it's, there's something, I didn't get into this, but I had sort of a similar, you know, visceral reaction about thinking about, you know, when it is pitch black out there, what do you do? You know, you kind of have to just feel your way and slowly, you know, slowly, and maybe there's that root on the ground that you're about to, that you trip over that you didn't notice was there, because when we see things, we don't even really have to consciously process that they're there. So, you know, we don't even think about that root, and then suddenly there it is. You know, you trip over it. But yeah, thank you for deepening that. Arhanas.
Thank you so much for just saying that word. Clarify.
Yeah.
Well, it made me think about an experience that I actually had in my life when my partner died. And I had to go, there was a lot of stuff that needed to be taken care of, especially with his family and all that. And I was a partner, but he had also his family. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be, and there was not much, you know, he had family. He was married all the time, so, and they were not really accepted of the whole situation. So I found myself in this dark room, and as you were explaining, and I visualized something. I said, well, if you are in this dark room, you need to go from point A to point B to find light. Mm-hmm. But there is this dark room that had a lot of furniture, and it was completely dark. And I needed to work without hurting myself or hurting anybody in the process and get the light out and for the process. It was kind of interesting that that's way to come, be very mindful, which incorporates the part of, you know, Sazen, and not to rush into it, but to just walk very slowly through it. Thankfully, it went very well, so it helped me to kind of visualize that I was in that dark.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, I really appreciate the illuminating comments from everybody, each in a different way.